Position number 22352, reel 1.
Graham Swain, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
St Thomas's Hospital, London.
Which year was this?
1924.
Did your parents come from that area?
Yes, Lambeth.
What was your address in the early days?
Hartington Road, Southwest 11, I think it was.
And did you grow up and have your schooling in Lambeth?
I started school in London. I went to South Lambeth Road Primary School, and then in about 1930 we moved to Bournemouth because my mother had what was then called consumption, and we were told that it was better to live in Bournemouth than London. So we moved there.
So really, Bournemouth is your hometown?
That's my recent base, as it were, yes.
How old were you when you finished schooling?
14.
In 38?
38, yes.
Did you then get a job?
Yes, I did. I worked for the Automobile Association, the AA, as a messenger boy. And I used to deliver the AA service in those days was very personal. If anybody wanted anything, it was delivered by hand in the Bournemouth area. And that's where I started.
Is that what you were doing when war was declared?
No. When war was declared... Yes, when war was declared, yes, I was working for the AA, yes. And I joined the Auxiliary Fire Service as a messenger. And our duties were, when the sirens went and everybody took shelter, we belted on our bikes to the fire station and they're reported. And whenever an appliance went out to a fire or an incident, one of these cycle messengers would hair after it to be the only means of communication and report back so many pumps required or incident over or that sort of thing. And then a year later, they started recruiting full-time motorcyclists. Well, I couldn't ride a motorcycle at the time, but I joined the National Fire Service full-time, trained as a dispatch rider, which later stood me in good stead when I joined the Army. And I stayed in the National Fire Service until I was called up at 18, or 18 and 3 or 4 months.
How much of the bombing of England did you experience personally?
Well, Bournemouth itself was not a specific target in the early days, although there was one terrible incident when they dive-bombed the Metropole Hotel, which was used as a transit camp for newly trained aircrew from Canada, and they killed about 40 or 50. That was a deliberate attack on Bournemouth. But Bournemouth was on the flyover route to Bristol, and it became apparent that if the Germans missed their target at Bristol, before they left to go back over the channel, they dropped odd bombs on Bournemouth. And there were many, many single instances of that. In addition to that, of course, being close proximity to Southampton, we provided mobile aid. And on several occasions, I came to Southampton when the Blitz was on to work there. It was called mobile aid at the time.
Were you living in Bournemouth when this dive bomb attack on the Metropole Hotel occurred?
No, I had moved then into the army. That was later. There is, in fact, a Commonwealth cemetery in Bournemouth, or a section of one of the big cemeteries there, is marked off with the normal Crusader cross, and all these chaps are commemorated there.
What personal experience of bombing did you have?
My own house, I suppose, was not hit, but the four or five doors up the road, it was there was a house, and a school friend of mine named Roy French was killed there. And my wife lived, she was not my wife then, of course, lived 3 or 4 roads further down, and the whole top of her road was hit one night. About 20 houses were bombed.
What was your address in Bournemouth?
many addresses. And my main address, I suppose, would be where we lived the longest was in Malmesbury Park Road, which was a typical working class area.
Did any bombs fall there?
Just at the top of the road, a crossroads called St. Leonard's Road. I referred to that a moment ago.
Were you at all frightened in the bombing?
Wasn't really. I was young and stupid, I suppose, because when everybody else was rushing to the shelters, we were hairing on our bikes to go to, and I suppose the exuberance of youth or something, it overtook any fears that they might have. Concerned, yes, but I wasn't frightened then. I was frightened later on in Italy, but that's another thing.
When you say you were a part-time cycle messenger,
yes.
How many hours did this involve you?
Well, it involved whenever the sirens went, as you probably know, at the beginning of the war, the slightest movement, the sirens would go off, and we were permitted to leave our place of employment, cycle to the fire station, and sometimes, before we got there, the all-clear had gone, so we'd return. It would be as many as two or three times a day at the commencement of the war. But when the radar people sorted themselves out, and when there were attacks, well, generally then it was necessary to go. So that could have been, you can't really equate it in hours. Sometimes it was 2 hours out of a day, sometimes longer. That was just a part-time. But, of course, when I was full-time, I was living in the fire station, working proper shifts. Forgot what we did. I think we did three days on and one day off, working full time.
Can you tell me some more, please, about this mobile support to Southampton and so on?
Yes, well, they would form the, if the Blitz went in Southampton, which was our nearest place, they'd form mobile columns of fire engines and ambulances, and we'd all troop down the A35 and assemble at Totten, which is a small town on the outskirts of Southampton. And there, we would then be called in to deal with any emergencies, fires that had occurred in Southampton. Of course, it's a bit difficult for us. We didn't know the town, the city now. We didn't know the town, and so we would just trundle along behind the fire engine. And when we got there, we'd be told where to report back, because no mobile phones or any means of communication. It was solely by messenger. Motorcyclists.
Can you give a description of what you saw of the bombing of Southampton, please?
We're talking now, the two big attacks on Southampton were in the late 40s, and the whole of the High Street was devastated in that one night. I just recall we were told to report to St. Mary's Fire Station, which was then the central fire station in Southampton, and the whole area was up in flames and things. I think that night they hit the gaswork, or they hit an air raid shelter near the gasworks at Northam, which was a large number of casualties there.
And were you doing dispatch rider
that,
work?
Solely that, so yes.
Was it easy to get through?
Oh yes, you can take a motorbike over rubble, but I mean I never didn't get where I was supposed to go. I got lost many times, of course. But I do recall I wasn't acquainted with a man at the time, but later on, when I joined the Southampton Police Force, I met an inspector, Vic White, who had been a peacetime member of the Horse Guards. And I later learned, and he wore the British Empire Medal, and he never talked about it. And I later learned that on the night that the gasworks were bombed, he was a police constable at the time, and had gone into an air raid shelter which had been hit, and there had been an escape of water, and part of the entrance to this air raid shelter was filled with water, and he actually dived in to this air raid shelter and pulled people out through the water. quite a brave act. But he never talked about it. Most modest man, and he died 2 or 3 years ago when the story actually became really public for the first time since the war.
And you also went to Bristol as well, didn't you?
I went to Bristol on 2 occasions, but the time we got there, our services were not required, so we returned. Of course, they called people up from Taunton, and no M5 then, of course.
How do you think public morale in places like Southampton stood up to the bombing?
Well, to be quite honest, at my age, I never thought about it. It just, people were there, people carried on. I didn't, nothing registered with me at that age that, you know, the end of the world is nigh. It's, oh God, not again. What do they call it? Stoicism, do they? That was my, bearing in mind, I'm still not 18 yet.
Did you think the Germans at this stage might win the war?
What did register with us, of course, was Dunkirk, because we had hundreds and hundreds of French troops arrived in Bournemouth and were billeted in the school that I had attended. And I suppose then, and my father had been in the First World War, but strangely enough, he never talked about the First World War to me. He didn't. He said, I'd had enough. I don't want any more to do with wars. But he did say, I don't like the look of this. And if my father said that, that was an ominous thing, you know. But, of course, we knew nothing about, in those days, about the preparations that Hitler had to come across the Channel and all that sort of thing. So, it didn't register with me personally.
Can you tell me about joining up now, please?
Joining up? Well, King George sent me the traditional brown letter to report to the 15th Infantry Training Centre, Hyderabad Barracks in Colchester. And I duly reported. And I shall always remember the first night. We walked in this place, and we didn't get there till about 10 o'clock. It was dark. There was a corporal there who said, there's a palliasse, there's a load of straw. Fill it up and go and put your head down over there. That was the incident. And some wag said, what about a pillow? Use your bloody boots. And that sticks in my mind. So my first night in the army. But there we were all the same. We were all green.
You know? Did you use your boots as a pillow?
Yes, we did. We did what we were told, didn't we? You wrapped your towel over there.
And then what?
And then what? Well, the usual. Well, I say, I didn't expect to remember these tiny details. I don't remember First Army breakfast, but being young and hungry, would eat anything. I do remember the messing arrangements. There was a long table, and the two people at the end were detailed as mess orderlies. One had to go up and get the bucket of tea, and the other one had to go and get the, whatever it was, scrambled egg or something. And of course, you quickly learned that it was the best place to be was mess orderly, because you were in charge of dishing out the portions. And then, of course, we were over to the stores to be kitted up and what have you. We had, I can't remember if we were sworn in or not. We were sworn in somewhere. I don't know whether it was at Colchester or whether it was after the medical, which happened to be in Southampton. I'm sure we were sworn in. We must have been. Everybody's sworn in, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so.
And then to the stores, and then the normal drill, square bashing. And in my particular case, after my first 6 weeks square bashing, I was posted to for Bren gun carrier training, and I qualified as a Bren gun carrier driver.
How did you take to the square bashing?
I liked it. Right. Yeah, I like bullshit.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know. I've always had a high regard for the services and straight backs and haircuts and all that sort of thing. I'm a bit of your old-fashioned soldier. And later on in the police service, when I became quite senior rank, my blokes knew they couldn't come in scruffy. Don't, you know, they had to smarten themselves up. There you go. Didn't get it from my father, because he didn't want to know about the army, but I suppose I like uniforms.
How were you treated by the people in charge of the basic training?
Well, you're treated like idiots, of course, and sworn at. I don't know if you've seen the recent programs about recruitment in the army, where the foul language that's used totally gratuitously, and it didn't get them anywhere at all. It lets them down. I don't ever remember, apart from amongst ourselves, using obscene language. And I certainly was never sworn at in an obscene manner by an NCO. I was shouted at, of course we were, and called bloody idiots and all that. But not the foul language that's used these days. It's part of our culture now, isn't it? I get 12-year-old kids walking past this house on their way. Girls, F in this, F in that, you know. I don't want to know about it. I've locked people up for that in years ago, using that word, so I don't like it. I'm not approved, and I can use it as, I've got as good a vocabulary as anybody, but there's a place for it. And it didn't really occur in my primary days.
So you weren't punished on the basic training?
No, I didn't. No, I was never on a 252 then.
A 252?
That's an army charge form. If you commit misconduct, do something wrong, you're on 252 as a charge. You appear before the commanding officer or the company commander or whatever.
Did you want to be a Bren gun carrier driver?
At that time, the thought of anything other than carrying a rifle appealed to me, because I knew that at that time they were looking, really, in my opinion, just for cannon fodder. I can't think of anybody in the intake that I was in, there were about 40 of us in that intake, that actually went on to one of the corps, that is, the Royal Signals, the RASC, or it wasn't REMI then, it was an Ordnance Corps. We all went to an infantry unit. They were looking for infantrymen at that time.
Can you tell me what being a Bren gun carrier driver involved?
An infantry battalion is divided into rifle companies, signal platoon, and a support company. And the support company comprises 3-inch mortars and a little armoured vehicle called a Bren gun carrier, on which a Bren gun is mounted. And of course, in actual practice, they weren't much damn good at all against a Tiger tank. The armor would withstand a rifle, small arms, but it wouldn't withstand anything else. And the idea was, in the early days, that you would go forward as a reconnaissance unit. It didn't always work like that, of course, because Jerry soon found with a blooming bazooka they could knock the thing over. But it was exciting. I mean, I wasn't walking. I was driving this 30 horsepower. It was a Ford. Well, I remember, 30 horsepower V Ford. And it was quite something.
Were they easy to drive?
Funny you should say that. There was one incident where you come out of Colchester and you go down a long, steep hill, and the railway station is on the left-hand side, and there was a roundabout in the centre. Now, the theory in driving a Bren gun carrier is, for the first about 5 degrees, when you turn the steering wheel, the track bows, right, to give you a veering to the left or right. But after that 5 degrees, the brake on the side to which you are turning starts to be applied. And consequently, if you're a bit heavy with it, you can spin the thing round by locking the left-hand track. Well, when I was actually under instruction, that's why nothing ever happened to me, I'm driving down this long road towards the railway station in Colchester, and well, perhaps I was going a bit too fast, I don't know, but I oversteered, and instead of gently moving round the roundabout, I spun. Of course, I spun into the flowers, didn't I? And the corporal wasn't very pleased. But I was under instruction, so I didn't... nothing happened to me, you know. But yes, they were easy to drive, once you got the hang of it. Yeah. Only like a car, really.
Did you also have to know how to fire the Bren gun?
Oh, yes. Well, that was part of your basic... I mean, every rifleman learned to fire the Bren gun, which was our light machine gun, LMG. The Germans had a thing called a Spandau, but ours was the Bren gun carrier. And if you heard the two firing, you knew which one it was, because the Spandau used to go blip, and the Bren gun would go pop, 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 pop. The sound was so, especially in Italy, when you know, that's not one of ours, that's one of theirs.
Did you have respect for the weapon, or were you critical of it?
Didn't know any different. It was what was supplied. We learned that it had been made in Czechoslovakia and had been adopted by the British Army. The only other machine gun which we used in the infantry was the Vickers, which was used by specialists trained to use a Vickers. I couldn't even, when I was in the Army, tell you how to fire a Vickers machine gun, because it was entirely different. And the other one, of course, was the Browning, which was 0.5, which was fitted to tanks and armoured vehicles. Yes, it was handy to carry, and you had a tripod, and we had all sorts of exercises, like firing at dive bombers and all that sort of thing. It was...
What happened to you next?
Next? Well, a stroke of fortune. At the end of the basic infantry training, we were all shot out to battalions to join a regular unit. But in my case, the permanent dispatch rider at the infantry training centre came off his bike and broke his arm or broke his leg or something. So they were short of a motorcyclist. And of course, I, like all kids, swanked, I could ride a motorbike and all that. And the next thing, I found myself posted to the orderly room as the dispatch rider for the administration, which was unheard of for a rookie to be doing that job. I mean, what's he doing here? These were all permanent staff, you know, blokes who'd been in the army 4 or 5 years. Anyhow, I was a dispatch rider for 5-6 months until this fellow came back. And then I was sort of a loose end. I'd lost my place in the queue, as it were. And I'd become very friendly with the people in the motor transport pool, because being a DR, I'd get my petrol and all that sort of thing. And the captain in charge of the motor transport pool said, I could do with you. You're quite a good motorcyclist. We've got to teach rookies how to ride motorcycles from back day one. So I was retained, once again, unheard of, because I'm still a rookie myself, training motorcyclists to learn to ride. And then they suddenly realised that I was not how old I was. I mean, I still wasn't 19 then. And they said, right, out you go. And I then caught up with the rest of the exports, as it were, to an infantry battalion. And we moved up to Woodall Spa in Lincolnshire, which was an infantry holding centre. And from there, we went up onto the Fylingdale Moors for battle training, where they fired live ammunition at us to, you know, frighten us to death. And then all of a sudden we heard, you're on a draft. And we get up at some ungodly hour, get on a train, don't know where we're going, and we finish up at Gourock, up on the Clyde. And we get on a tender and we go out to this thing, and I'll never forget, it was an Indian boat called the SS Tacliwa, and it stunk of curry, and I'd never had curry in my life. All Indian crew, Anyway, we're out there for about a day and a half whilst, I mean, we didn't know this, whilst the convoy was forming up. And then all of a sudden we're sailing, you see. And the wise ones amongst us who knew, who could read the stars and signs, oh, we're going to the States, because we were sailing due west. And then the next day, we were sailing due east. The convoy went out and then back. And then my next memory of it, of course, we had the usual, we were sleeping. I was down on E deck, which is right at the bowels of the ship with hammocks and all that. We'd have never got out if we'd have been hit. We wouldn't have had a hope in hell. My memory of that ship, apart from the cramped conditions and all that sort of thing, was the fact that we had fresh baked bread, white bread, every day, from the ship's bakery, which is, you know, something unheard of. And the other thing is, we had access to a naffy once a day, and you could buy tins of carnation milk, you know, the white, the and we used to pop this and drink this carnation milk neat. That was the extent of it. It was no alcohol.
It's known as evaporated milk.
You've got it. And there's a funny little thing sticks in your mind. No cigarettes or anything. But we could buy soap, you know, on there. And then suddenly, one night, we must have been sailing for about 7 or 8 days, we suddenly became aware of a glare of bright lights just ahead of us. And as we got closer to it, we realised that these were small fishing blokes with acetylene lamps. And they were sardine fishermen from Portugal, which was neutral, of course. And we thought, bloody hell, we'd be silhouetted against these things. And I was worried then, because the U-boats were... Anyhow, we did pass through the Straits of Gibraltar, and we then realised that we were going up the Med. And then we pulled into a place called Philippeville, which is Algeria way. And we pop out there, and that is an infantry holding area. Well, this was September, and the landings in Salerno had just taken place. And if you know anything about the history of the Italian campaign, that the landings at Salerno were almost a Gallipoli, because General Mark Clark, who was in charge of the American Fifth Army, said, and had apparently discussed the evacuation of the troops there because of the strong opposition. In any event, it didn't happen, and so all the Bakshi bods who were in North Africa were whisked across to Salerno to reinforce. By that time, they had pushed out a bit, so I didn't actually take part in the Salerno landings, but I was in the immediate follow-up. And I was posted then to the 7th Battalion, the Oxenbucks Light Infantry, because I didn't mention, but when I was at Colchester, there were three or four regiments which were designated, and I happened to go to a light infantry regiment, and I joined the 7th Battalion as a rifleman, and I thought this was ominous, 13 Platoon C Company.
Had you had some cap badge in England?
Yes, yeah, a light infantry badge.
Which was
a Somerset light infantry, but I was not a member of the regiment, and my regimental records don't show that, you know.
Were you happy to join the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry?
Didn't have any option, did I?
What kind of reception did you get from them?
Oh, it was all very. They were so pleased to see some reinforcements, because they took some heavy losses at the Salerno landings, particularly at an airfield called Battipaglia, which changed hands about four times, and they really had some hard times. And then off I went and went into action for the first time. And it was then I was frightened.
Can you give as many details as you can recollect about your first time in action, please?
That part of Italy, there's so many mountains, so many rivers, which was Churchill's description of Italy. Always one more mountain. So it was on a mountain, and somewhere just north of Naples, and we form up, and we've got to take over from I don't know what regiment we were taking over from, but we'd go up a file along this edge of the mountain, as it were. There's mules coming down with stretchers, actually on the mules, and we thought, oh, this is a nice welcome. Anyhow, we get up into this holding area, and there's two of us told there is a sanger. Well, in